Welcome, everyone. This is the eighth and final office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Anatomy of the Fed. Today is August 18th, 2012. And so we've finished all the lectures, and now this is, like I say, the final office hours, and I'm here to field any questions you might have about the final. I haven't written the final yet, but I'll write it before this coming Thursday and post that. So for those of you taking the course for credit, structurally it will be like there is a quiz 9, except instead of it being quiz 9, it'll be the final exam, and it'll cover the entire course. And just so you know, I'll explain this all in the email that I send out once the thing is written. But the final is somewhat challenging, whereas these quizzes have been real easy. So again, in case you didn't catch that in the beginning when I explained it, the point of the quizzes is just to keep you honest. It's just to force you to actually watch the lectures, to actually go do the reading. It's not supposed to be separating the men from the boys, as it were. Whereas on the final, I do want it to be a little bit challenging so that somebody who gets a 99 on the final is actually a really good student, and I can tell understands the material, as opposed to you could get 100% on all the quizzes, and that I wouldn't know whether you were a budding Rothbardian. It would just mean you do the reading and stuff like that. Okay, we got some questions that got posted. I know we have some new people logged in today. Somebody emailed me and said he was the first. This is the first time he's ever been able to make the office hours. So, hang on. This guy's still emailing. I just want to make sure he's not left out high and dry. Sorry, when I just wanted to make sure this one time this guy could participate, he could get in. Okay, so just to finish that train of thought, for those of you who are new here, you've never been to office hours, just go ahead and type your questions right into the main chat box. You don't need to wait for me to finish answering. Okay, Bhavesh says, what would you recommend on the investment front? Specifically, what percentage of personal net worth would you recommend in gold and gold stocks? Would you also recommend investing in some other asset? Okay, it would be ludicrous for me to throw up an actual number, just because I haven't studied that stuff. I'm not a financial planner, and so I really have no idea. It would be silly for me to even throw out a number. Also, because I think if you were going to advise somebody like that, it would depend on what the person's situation was. Like, so for me, if let's say the dollar crashes next month and price inflation and gasoline goes up to $10 a gallon because the dollar falls internationally, so the price of crude oil in dollars all of a sudden goes to $200 a barrel and that kind of stuff. Me personally, Bob Murphy, would possibly benefit financially from that because that's the one big red mark on my professional career so far is that I was one of the louder ones in the Austrian camp warning about price inflation because of what Bernanke was doing, and that's what people keep throwing at me right now. Like, oh yeah, Bob Murphy, he's a funny guy, he gives good talks and stuff, but he was totally wrong on inflation. So I would all of a sudden look like a genius if that were to happen, and people might be flying me out, and I might be giving talks at various places and stuff, like, oh, the guy who called the dollar crash along with Peter Schiff and others, right? Not that I'm the only one who's done that. Okay, so even though I personally want to stock up on gold and silver in case that crash comes, which I think is coming, I actually would be okay. Like my income would adjust accordingly. I have a fixed rate mortgage on my house. You know, I'm trying to pay off any kind of variable rate credit card debt I might have. So I'm just saying I actually don't need that huge, a big reserve fund that will respond in case the dollar crashes because of my situation. Whereas when I'm talking to my dad, who's retired and he's young and relatively young for someone who could be my dad, and he might have to live another 40 years off of what he's saved. Well, with him, he really has to be careful, and so I want him, I mean, I've said that, you know, it gets me nervous when he reduces his exposure to a gold ETF and his holdings, and I try to talk him out of it and want him to err on the side of having more gold. So I would want him to have at least 10%, not because there's some magic number of 10, just that seems like, sure, why not? So, that's what I would say. So if you have if you work at some factory and that's a full-time job for you and you don't have any other sources of income and you think you'd probably keep that job if the dollar crashes and so it's just sort of that you want to have a big stockpile, well then, I mean, one way to do it would be to do it backwards and say, okay, how many months of my basic expenses do I want to be able to afford if the dollar were to crash? Because, like, that's what I said, like, in my case, if I had, like, 3 months of expenses, in other words, if I figured out, okay, what's my minimum monthly mortgage payment, pay for my kid's tuition and his private school, blah, 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 you know, all the stuff that I kind of have to keep doing, and then write that number down times, let's say, 3, so I got 3 months worth, and then say, okay, how much gold would I need to hold so that at the current gold price, I could do that. So then, even if the dollar crashes, presumably gold would respond at least as much, if not more so. So I still would have enough gold to get me through 3 months, even if I had no income, because I'm thinking, given my odd situation professionally, since I'm a consultant and I don't have long-term contracts with a lot of people, my nominal income would probably, by the fourth month, if the dollar were to crash, I probably would be able to cash flow it again. In other words, I could meet my basic expenses with what my nominal income would be from 4 months on, even in a nightmare scenario, because, like I said, I've been predicting this nightmare, so I'm in a weird situation, whereas for somebody who works at a regular job, you're not going to get a raise 3 months later if the dollar crashes. Maybe next year you can renegotiate and you can say to your employer, hey, look, come on, gasoline $10 a gallon, a loaf of bread is $3, this is crazy. Well, probably more than that. This is crazy, I need a raise, and maybe you'd get it. But the point is, if you're just a regular guy working at a factory job or something, you would want to have a lot more gold and silver to get you over that hump before your nominal wages adjust to the new price level. So that's the way I would do it. So instead of me throwing out a number for you, I think you should do it that way, like just figure out the sort of scenario you're worried about, what would actually be your situation, and how much gold would you want. So the other question, what did you say? Would you also recommend investing in some other asset? Well, again, the answer is not the same for everybody. So I, for sure, what I think people should be doing is I almost think there's too much emphasis in libertarian circles on, oh, what do I do with my money, my wealth right now? What's the composition of my wealth right now? I think the real big thing you should be doing, especially if you're young, and I don't know how old you are, Bhavesh, but for younger people, I mean, it almost seems weird to me when somebody who's in college comes up to me and is asking me about investing advice. Because I almost want to say 95% of the wealth that's ever going to go through your hands in your life, you've yet to touch. Or if not, then that's something's wrong. You know, if you're just in college right now, you ought to have most of the wealth in your future because you should be out, you know, cranking out, generating income and hence accruing wealth much more in the future when you get out of college than what you've been doing thus far in your life. So what I would say to younger people is don't think of it so much as what do I want to invest in right now so when the dollar crashes, I'm fine. Think of it more, I want to start developing multiple streams of income right now so when the dollar crashes, and if my company goes under and I get laid off, I've got these three other side businesses I had going that I can ramp up. Because that's really, I think, the only long-term solution. I mean, if you're retired, like I said, the advice I was giving my dad, who's sitting on a nice little nest egg that he thought would get him through until he dies of natural causes, there, I mean, that's one thing. You've got a lot of money to play with in there. Yeah, you could if you put it in gold or whatever. That could be a huge windfall if things happen and gold goes up to 2,500 an ounce or something. But for even for me right now, I mean, when I think about how much can I possibly put aside each month and how much gold can I accumulate, in the grand scheme of things, it's not all that much. Just because, like, just where I am right now in my career and everything, and like I have all these huge fixed expenses. My son goes to a really expensive private school and so on. I mean, sure, I would rather have 50 ounces of gold than 3 if the dollar crashes. But even if I had 50, in the grand scheme, that's not going to rescue me. I'm still going to have to go out and figure out how to earn an income above the standard of living that I would want if there's a really bad scenario. So that's what I would tell people is, especially if you're under 35, I would think of it more not what assets do I want to own, what physical or financial assets, but more how do I develop my human capital right now? How do I get certain businesses set up now? How do I start working that stuff? Because what you don't want to have happen, you know, if this catastrophe comes that a lot of us think is going to happen, you don't want to be trying to start your first business because you got laid off from your job and now you have 8 weeks of savings in the bank or under your pillow if you have gold coins or something. You don't want to be under the gun like that and have 8 weeks to develop a business from scratch. You want to already have other things that you had set up, already have a bunch of clients, already know, you know, have your accountant all set up and all this. You know what I mean? You don't want to have to do all that from scratch when you realize I have 8 weeks and then my kid's going to start going hungry. You don't want to be in that environment. You want to already have the stuff up and running so that people go to you instead of going to your competitors who are themselves just trying to start a business in the same area that you're in. Okay, Lewis says... Oh, and one last thing on that, Bhavesh. Also, when you are thinking of what kind of stuff could I do, obviously pick something that will be relatively prosperous if this scenario occurs. So one thing that I used to throw out because people would want something specific, I would say, okay, if you think you could be a landlord, whereas I couldn't, I don't even... If the gutters break in my house, I don't even want to deal with it. I'd call somebody else, right? So I would be an awful landlord. And plus, I can't be tough with people, right? So if somebody weren't paying me, it would be hard for me to kick them out. Okay, I just couldn't do that personality-wise. So I would be just the worst landlord possible. So it's not for me, but for people who could be landlords, who are pretty handy and could fix stuff and don't mind taking a Saturday and going and fixing somebody's water heater or whatever, I would say, well, you know, a decent thing might be if you bought a bunch of low-rent apartment units and you had a fixed-rate mortgage on them. Because if the dollar crashes, there's going to be a lot of people, and people still need to live somewhere, so there's still going to be a demand for low-rent apartments. Even if the people who live in them right now couldn't afford it, you got to evict all them, there's going to be people right now who are living in middle-class homes that would then default on their mortgage and get kicked out, and then they'd have to go to the real cheap apartment housing units that you own. All right, so the point is you're going to have demand for low-rent apartment units if there's a catastrophe. And the benefit is there, since you're the landlord, you can raise the rent commensurate with what happens with the dollar, at least, you know, if there's turnover in your contracts. And if you have a fixed-rate mortgage, then your monthly expenses for the property are going to be fixed. So you could be in actually a nice situation where you're pulling in a lot more every month from your tenants than you need to pay to the bank on your mortgage for the property. So that, I mean, that's one example. But you wouldn't want to do that with like luxury condos or something, because if there is another crash, no, you're not going to be able to fill those things up the way you can right now. And so you're going to be stuck with this property that's awful, and you're going to just want to get rid of it. So you don't want to be into that. You don't want to open a business. You don't want to say, oh, yeah, I've always liked to deal in a really expensive jewelry, so I'm going to open a jewelry store downtown at this really prime location and cater to all the rich wives. That would not be something that would be smart to do right now. if you agree with me that an economic crash is coming, because that's the kind of store nobody's going to go to when times are awful. So, you know, I can give vague recommendations like that, but again, I couldn't possibly say, oh, go do this, because that might not be in your area of interest or expertise. Okay, Lewis says, Dr. Murphy, I am currently writing on a master's thesis mostly based on what we have been learning through this course, and I quote you in some passages, is it still a work in progress, or it is still a work in progress, but when I finish it up, may I send it to you so you can revise it? By the way, any news on the advanced certificate for those of us who complete the entire series of three courses on Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, Mises, Theory of Money, and Credit? Okay, so yes, Lewis, you can certainly send it to me and just put in the subject line something like master's thesis I asked you about in office hours or something, because I get tons of people send me stuff, and as a general rule, I just tell them I'm too busy, I can't read it, but I don't want to do that to you, but I might forget the context, so just in the subject line, make sure you jog my memory. As far as the advanced certificate, that's not my call to make. I don't know, so Danny Sanchez would know that, so you can, if you want to email him and ask him, but I personally don't know, because that's not my area of, I have nothing to do with that, in other words. Okay, Brad says, let me see if I understand this correctly. An operation twist, and then he's got a colon, A, if the Fed swaps short-term bonds for long-term, then there was no revenue generated. If the Treasury wanted income, they would sell the short-term bonds back to the Fed, and the Fed would print money to buy them. Okay, so, right. But I mean, yeah, what you're saying is true, but let me just talk a little bit about that to make sure people aren't getting confused. So in Operation Twist, well, first of all, in general, the Fed does not directly buy Treasury securities at Treasury auctions. The Fed is always going into the secondary market. All right, so even if the Fed were just expanding its balance sheet and buying newly issued Treasury bonds, effectively printing money and handing it over to Uncle Sam to spend, strictly speaking, they work through a middleman. There's somebody in the private sector, a dealer, primary dealer, that would go to the auction, would lend money to the federal government. The federal government would give them Treasury securities, and then those primary dealers would sell the securities to the Fed, which would then put them on its balance sheet, and the Fed would then just put a bunch of extra zeros in the checking account balances of the banks where those primary dealers had their own checking accounts. Okay, so I think you know that, Brad. I just want to make sure people aren't getting confused. So you're right. Now, if we're talking about Operation Twist, again, the Fed's dealing with the secondary market. They're not dealing directly with the Treasury, but here they're buying long-term treasuries from some sellers, and they're selling short-term treasuries to some buyers, conceivably the same person, but it doesn't need to be. So on net, from the Fed's point of view, its total holdings measured in dollar terms haven't changed. It's just they've changed the composition of their holdings. And from the Treasury's point of view, absolutely nothing changes when the Fed does Operation Twist. From the Treasury's point of view, they had already held auctions, borrowed a bunch of money from people, and issued both short-term and long-term liabilities from the Treasury's point of view. You know, they owe people money. Whoever ends up holding these bonds, we owe money to. So they already took in all that money when they were running a budget deficit and auctioned off those Treasury bonds, and now all that's happening in the form of Operation Twist, from the Treasury's point of view, it's just those outstanding Treasury securities are getting rearranged among different people out there. But from the Treasury's point of view, they're still having the same outflow of interest payments and then principal payment when the thing matures. It's just the identity of the owner might be different based on because of Operation Twist. Okay, and then you had a part B. So then Brad also says, then says B, if the Fed sold short-term bonds to buy long-term bonds, unless there was another buyer, they would simply print money to retire the short-term and then buy the long-term. No, I'm not sure what you're getting at there, Brad. If you mean what I think you mean, then no, that's not right. So the Federal Reserve cannot retire Treasury securities. Incidentally, in case people are getting confused by the terminology, I'm basically using Treasury bond and Treasury security interchangeably. The reason technically there's a difference is that with federal government debt, they break it up. So the term bond could just be generic. It could just mean anytime somebody borrows money and then you have to pay the person back with interest. But in terms of federal government issuing those sorts of things, they split it up in terms of treasury notes, treasury bills, and treasury bonds. You might have heard of T-bills. That's a treasury bill. Okay, so there the distinction has to do with the maturity. And so in one generic sense, they're all bonds, but if you're talking to an actual bond trader and you say treasury bond, he might think you mean the long-term things, and as opposed to it, he might say, oh, well, you couldn't possibly mean a three-month security because that would you should call that a T-bill. Why do you call that a bond? It's not a bond, it's a T-bill. Well, you see what I'm saying? So it is a bond, but in the nomenclature of the actual guy dealing with the stuff, they wouldn't call that a bond. So the generic term that covers everything is treasury security. That could be a note, a bill, or a bond. So that's, in case you're getting confused, that's why I'm using those different phrases. So Brad, let me just finish that point, and then I see you're chiming in below. So swoop down and see if I'm helping. But the Treasury and the Fed are technically distinct in terms of their bookkeeping. So the Fed is a buyer of Treasury bonds, or Treasury securities, and the Treasury, when it makes interest payments, so it takes in tax revenue, and one of the big components now of the federal budget is paying interest on the federal debt, because there are all these outstanding Treasury securities, the owners of which are due interest payments. So the federal government, out of tax revenue, has to pay that stuff out. It was like $250 billion or something last fiscal year. Don't quote me, that's a round figure. Just in interest payments on the federal debt. So to the extent that the Federal Reserve is the owner of a bunch of that federal government debt, they are the legal recipients of a lot of those interest payments. Now the quirk is the way the Fed is structured, after it pays its expenses, pays the dividend payment to the member banks and so on, if it has more income left over for that accounting period, it remits those excess earnings back to the Treasury. So there's a sense in which the Treasury doesn't really pay the full stated interest on federal debt if the Fed happens to own it. But they go through the motions. They do pay the Fed as if the Fed were any other holder of its securities, and then the Fed, when all is said and done, says, oh, we have all this extra money this year, we'll give it to the Treasury. But the Fed does not have the power to retire Treasury debt. All right, so let me just see what Brad's all right, well, it looks like you're asking something else. Okay, so anyway, Brad, if I did not get your question there, just follow up with it. Okay, Kay Warren says, although credit cards are credit slash loan, they do function with a certain moneyness. As unsecured debt, it does figure heavier into money function. Is there an aggregate taking this into account? Also, is the conventional M's, by which I think K means, you know, M1, M2, M3, of much meaning these days? Okay, this is this is a tricky one. And I've gone back and forth on this myself, especially since, as some of you may know, I have had public disagreements with, what the heck is that guy's name? With Mish, the famous financial blogger who's very sympathetic to the Austrian school on many issues. Because Mish is, he defines his aggregate for what he says is determines which way prices move, if we're going to have inflation or deflation. He looks at money and credit, is the way he puts it. So I don't, having said that, I don't know if Mish includes credit cards in there or not. I mean, for sure he puts bank credit in there, but I don't know if he actually puts credit cards in there or not. So, but anyway, so that is an issue, and I think it's, well, so for one thing, Kay, I do think it's really important that we're clear about the distinction between actual money versus credit, just in order for a newcomer to understand what those things are, and that there really is a difference between me going to the store and paying with a debit card versus paying with a credit card. Because strictly speaking, if I pay with a credit card, what's happening is there's some other entity out there that has the money that gives those funds to the store owner, and now I have a debt to the credit card company. All right, so at no point there was money created out of thin air, and that's different from me going to a commercial bank and borrowing $1,000 from them if they engage in fraction reserve banking, and then I go out and start writing checks on it. And so the reason for that difference is, if you really want to put your finger on it, that the community tends to treat deposits at commercial banks as being transferable money, as a medium of exchange, more than they would treat credit with a credit card company. Okay, so in other words, if I go to Chase Bank and I say, hey, I want to take out a home equity loan because I want to go buy some material and fix my deck up or something, that's, and then they go ahead and credit my account, and I have now $10,000 in my checking account. And then I go around and I start hiring carpenters and whatever, going to Home Depot and buying some stuff and writing checks. It's like I have the $10,000, it's mine, and then I'm going to give it to them. Whereas if I go to First Financial Bank and say, hey, I want a credit card, and they look at my credit history and say, okay, here you go, you got a $10,000 line of credit, and I start going around town spending that, the merchant is not going to, let's say American Express to make it easier, the merchant is not going to just accept that now, oh, okay, now I, the merchant, have a $5,000 balance with American Express if I buy $5,000 worth of stuff. No, they're going to actually want to get paid in money. You see what I mean? So the fact that American Express is running around saying, oh, someone has a line of credit with us, I can't transfer that mere line of credit to somebody else, and then they're going to give me goods and services for that. Whereas with a commercial bank, that actually is kind of what happens, that even if no money leaves their vault, and I go up to them and I say, I want a $10,000 home equity line of credit, and they say, fine, and they give it to me, and they put it in my checking account, and I go to spend it somewhere, especially if the merchant is a client of that same bank, commercial bank, there's no actual dollar bills have to leave the vault. It's just now on the commercial bank's books, they just transfer and say, oh, Murphy just spent $5,000 at Home Depot, so instead of saying he's got $10,000 in his checking account, now we'll say he's got $5,000. And our account, Home Depot happens to have their account with us too, we'll add $5,000 to their account. So Home Depot was perfectly happy to give me $5,000 worth of stuff just so that now the numbers that they have at Chase Bank or wherever went up by $5,000. Okay, so that's, so it gets a little bit tricky when you start thinking it through like that. My advice would be, if you're trying to understand the distinction between money and credit cards, first just think through the logic of it. If you had 100% reserve gold back, or just gold money community, and just think through what would credit cards mean in that environment, because you still could have credit cards there. So there, what would happen is American Express, you know, you go to American Express and you say, hey, I want to apply for a credit card. And they say, okay, we look at your credit history, we'll approve you up to a credit limit of 5 ounces, because remember, everything's quoted in ounces of gold in this world. So you, now you're walking on this plastic card, and you go and you want to buy a bunch of fancy clothes that have a price of, you know, you go to the cash register, they ring you up, and it's 3 ounces of gold is the price. You don't have 3 ounces of gold on you. You pull out your credit card, you swipe it. They say, oh, there you go, sign this. Okay, and you walk out with the clothes. But again, what actually happened there is, in order for American Express to be able to do that, they had to have saved up a bunch of actual gold. And they have that on a deposit with 100% reserve bank somewhere. And then with the credit, with the merchant, when you swiped your credit card, technically what happened behind the scenes is American Express paid the merchant, like as if they wrote a check and said, okay, the money, the gold coins we have in the vault at the bank are now credited to your account. So the merchant got paid with gold. And then all that happens now is on the side, you owe American Express 3 ounces of gold that's now rolling over at interest. Okay, so that's what's going on with a credit card transaction. So it's the way I would explain it is, you're right, the introduction of credit cards would, I think, other things equal, push up prices in a certain community. But the way I would explain it is not to say now there's more money. I would say rather the demand to hold actual money goes down. Because now if I'm a consumer and I'm walking around, I don't need to have as much gold either on me physically or in my checking account balance, because if I want to make a big purchase, I just pull up my credit card. And so I don't, my cash balances, the amount of gold I want to hold in equilibrium, is now lower than it otherwise would be. But that's true for anybody who's walking around out the credit card. So that means the community's demand to hold gold has just gone down. So if the quantity of gold is the same and the demand to hold it goes down, that means the purchasing power of the gold goes down. But that's the flip side of saying in the community, the prices of things quoted in gold ounces goes up. So that's, so that there certainly is a connection between, or superficially, it might look like all of a sudden the introduction of credit is quite similar to someone discovering a bunch of new gold and it inflows into the community. But I think theoretically, that's not the way I think about it. I try to keep it compartmentalized and say, no, what is the actual stock of gold or money? And then what's the credit, and how might the existence of that credit affect the demand to hold money? When you asked about the M1s and so on, for sure credit cards are not an M1 or M2. Well, for sure they're not an M1. I'm almost positive they're not an M2. M3, I don't know what's in M3 off the top of my head. Okay, Tony Cape says, I'm hoping to dig further into the moral case against the Fed. My first point would be to describe the theft involved with counterfeiting and fractional reserve banking and how it's put on steroids via the Federal Reserve. What are your thoughts on the moral aspect? Yeah, well, I guess I would go at it more and say, what does it mean for the, like, how does the Fed maintain its position? And it's only through threatening people, ultimately. In other words, if a bunch of people in the private sector try to just form a Fed, it wouldn't have worked. That in order for the Fed to be the Fed, in order for it to get away with the stuff that it does, it ultimately is backed up by the power of the government. Meaning, if there's some commercial bank out there that doesn't want to follow the Fed rules, ultimately guys with guns will show up at your property and punish you. So, that's how the Fed gets to be able to do the stuff you're talking about. So, that might be the way to go about it, is to show that by its very nature, what we mean when we talk about a central bank can only be a central bank if it has, in a sense, some sort of monopoly privilege or this special position that's ultimately backed up by the government's ability to throw people in cages. Okay, Tony Cape says, Murphy versus Schiff on the timing magnitude of the upcoming collapse. Are we headed to a Mad Max scenario or something fairly mild like the last few years? Well, I don't know if I want to say Mad Max, but I am, for Barron's right now, I am reviewing Peter Schiff's latest book called something like The Real Crash or something like that. And so there, it's very interesting. I'm only like 40 pages into it at the moment. But I love Schiff's thesis, right? And he sets it up right in the introduction. And he said, a lot of people come up to me and they pat me on the back and say, hey, Peter, great job. We'll call him The Crash, referring to the housing crash. And Schiff says, I appreciate the kind words and everything, but what people don't understand is the crash I was predicting hasn't come yet. He said, what we've seen so far is just the prelude to the crash. We still, in this country, have not dealt with all of the imbalances and all the other stuff that I was worried about back in 2006. So he said, we started to see a taste of it, and if the policymakers had just stood back and done nothing, it really would have been, we would have seen the full blowout. But the policymakers didn't step back and let it happen. They fought it as hard as they possibly could with TARP and all that stuff, and, of course, all the stuff the Fed has done. So Schiff is saying all they did was postpone it. We still have to have the day of reckoning, and just as the crisis in 2008, had they stood back and just let it happen, would have been way worse than what the dot-com crash would have been in 2001 if Alan Greenspan had stood back and just let it happen. By the same token, Schiff says, the coming crash is going to be a lot worse than what we were worried about in 2008. So as far as all that, I am in total agreement. I mean, I've been saying the exact same thing since 2008. We're even also in agreement on when people say, okay, well then what's the bubble now? And Schiff says it's in government debt, and I say the same thing. That to me, it is ludicrous. The yield on 30-year U.S. Treasuries right now. I don't understand how that's possible. And I've talked with some people. I haven't actually talked with bond traders. I should try to find some of them. But I've talked with hedge fund guys and stuff, and I'm asking them, how can that be? What's the story? And I still don't know exactly. In other words, what I mean is you can look at what are called TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So those are bonds, special bonds that the Treasury issues that will update the principal on the face amount with changes in the CPI. And so the idea is that they keep your principal intact. So if you buy $10,000 worth of those things today and you're supposed to earn a certain interest, let's say you're supposed to earn whatever, 2% on it, And so you keep getting paid 2% on what right now is $10,000 per year. And then after 20 years, they give you your $10,000 back, right? Well, if you're worried about inflation, you could buy the Treasury Inflation Protected Security. So what's neat about those is every year, I think it's every year, they look and they say, okay, what was the change in the CPI from last year to this year? And so if CPI went up 3%, we apply that to the face amount of your TIPS security. So now instead of us saying that these are a $10,000 worth, now it's $10,300. And so we start paying you that same nominal interest rate on the $10,300 base. And then after 20 years, if there were no more inflation, if the CPI stayed the same, we would give you $10,300 back. And they just keep updating it. So in theory, the nominal yield on those TIPS should be pretty close to what the real rate of interest is, right? Because that's supposed to say how much do investors need to be paid in order to compensate them for just deferring their potential consumption, not in order to also deal with the loss in purchasing power, because the face amount is supposed to be adjusted with changes in CPI. So you should be kept whole as far as what you can go out in the marketplace and buy with your money. It's just how much do you have to be compensated to part with that ability to consume for 20 years. So if you look at, but that nominal just normal Treasury securities don't have that adjustment factor. They just say, okay, you gave us $10,000 today, we'll pay you this nominal interest rate going forward, and then after 20 years, we'll give you $10,000 back. So the nominal rate you get paid there is supposed to incorporate your expectations about what's going to happen with prices over the next 20 years. And so you're going to want to get a higher nominal rate on that thing because it's just being applied to that $10,000. So by looking at the difference between the two, right, if you take a Treasury security that's equal in all other respects except one of them's TIPS and one of them's not, that difference theoretically should be the expectations of price inflation, right? So in other words, the nominal interest rate on the regular one is higher than the interest rate on the TIPS. And that makes sense because the TIPS is a better contract for you, so you would get a lower yield on it as a lender. And so that difference should be reflecting the assumptions of price increases. There's, if you really get complicated, there's other things because like the regular bond market is more liquid than the TIPS market and stuff like that. But you get what I'm saying. From 30,000 feet, you would think that the difference between those two is a pretty good proxy for what the market thinks of long-term price increases. And that difference is pretty low right now. In other words, it's looking at that naively, you would think the bond market right now believes Bernanke when he says CPI is going to increase core CPI, around 2% a year for the next 20 years. And to me, that's insane. Who could possibly think that? So to me, when people say, where's the bubble? I want to say it's in government bonds right now. I cannot believe the implicit expectations that are embedded in these market prices. So just like a lot of people back in 2005 were looking at home prices and saying, what in the world? These are crazy. These are way too high. There's no way, given what likely rental rates are going to be and what landlords could charge to tenants and so forth going forward, that these home prices could possibly be sustained. There's no way. So that's what I'm thinking in terms of bond prices right now for the U.S. So you're talking about timing. I've kind of started to shut up about that stuff unless someone explicitly asked me because I've been wrong. I would have thought it would have hit already. So I have no idea about the timing because I can't understand why it's persisted this long. People will say stuff like, oh, well, once the Fed really starts monetizing the debt, then we'll be in trouble. Well, the last figure I saw said that in 2011, 77% of the net new debt issued by the federal government ended up on the Fed's books. So it's like already the Fed last year bought 77% of the newly issued debt, paid for by printing money, metaphorically. So at what percentage do people start thinking the Fed is monetizing the debt? You know, does it have to be 100% that for a certain calendar year, literally every dollar that the federal government borrows, the Fed just created? I mean, and I could even see people saying, well, no, that's just running this year's budget deficit. I mean, but as long as the Fed's not going out and grabbing debt that's already been issued, then we're fine. I mean, it's – anyway. So the point, my answer, Tony, is I don't know about the timing because I can't believe the fact that 77% of last year's debt was monetized isn't causing people to start getting alarmed. So since that didn't do it, I don't know what will. Okay. But in terms of what I think the big picture is, let me just do this little progression. So in 2000, 2001, the dot-coms crashed. If the government stood back and did nothing, a lot of people would have been in trouble because the tech stock market collapsed. All right, so that would have wiped out a lot of wealth, you know, paper wealth. But, okay, because the Fed intervened, all that stuff, that was transformed into a situation in 2008 where if the government had done nothing, a lot of major household banks and investment firms would have gone down. Okay, so 2000, 2001 would have just been some, you know, tech companies and maybe some hedge funds that had been heavily invested in them, but nothing, no household name would have gone down. Whereas 2008, we already had Bear Stearns go down, we had Lehman go down, and had the government done nothing and the Fed done nothing, I think, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, a lot of those household names would have gone down. And so that would have been pretty awful. Okay. Because they intervened, whatever, now I think the next time the crash comes, you're going to see governments go down. And by go down, I don't necessarily mean there's going to be a revolution, but I mean various governments are going to have to default, like major governments, not, you know, not some podunk, not Somalia, not Zimbabwe, but the Greek government, the Spanish government, the Italian government. And then they'll probably get one more burst, and then I think ultimately it will be the British government and the U.S. government that will have to default, or they'll just inflate and destroy their currencies. So there's at least one more round they could do. I think when it gets to the point where the U.S. government is actually in danger of having to default, they could just push it off one more round by transferring it to the dollar itself. And then once the dollar itself is gone and people lose confidence in the dollar, well, there's nothing left they can do. So it doesn't need to get to that point. They could just stop it at the U.S. government, but I don't think they will. Okay. George Smith says, do you have any sites or Fred charts to recommend for monitoring Fed activity? Yeah, I mean, you can even just Google Federal Reserve balance sheet, and they update that thing in real time. It would be like the, what is that, H14 release, something like that. The thing that I told you, I'm getting the numbers mixed up maybe. That thing would be good just for the Fed's balance sheet. You can, if you scroll down, you can actually find the link to the Fed's balance sheet, because in the beginning they just talk about factors that affect Federal Reserve balance sheet. As far as the issue, the thing about what about the excess reserves, what about them leaking out, if you go to Fred, you can see that it's under reserves. So what? Let me just do it right now so I'm not telling you something wrong. Oops. Hang on. I got to get to my browser. Okay, so if you're at the Fred place, under the first headings, money, banking, and finance, if you go to monetary data and then reserves. Then from within there, pull up excess reserves and just regular reserves and look at those two. And so when they're the same, it's fine, because that means all the excess, all the reserves that have been pumped in are still excess, meaning they're just sitting at the bank. I mean, it's not fine, meaning it's benign, but they're still bottled up in the commercial banking system. But if you ever saw the reserves line staying high and then excess reserves plummeting, so there's this big, big gap between the two, what that would mean is the banks are now lending out those excess reserves. So the excess reserves are now just being turned back into regular reserves. So that's when, if you started to see that happen, then you would really expect significant price inflation. Okay, Pedreg says, hi Bob, since March of 2009, global central banks have pumped $10 trillion into the financial system. Is there any approximate value that can be derived to estimate how much of this liquidity went to purchasing equities, bonds, and commodities on the various exchanges since then? I don't think so. I mean, somebody might be able to come up with a way to try to gauge that, but sometimes I think people get a little bit mixed up. If the Fed creates money, and you know, Fed creates an extra $1 trillion, and then people sometimes will say, oh yeah, that went into the stock market. Well, remember, it's not literally that there was money in the commercial banking system and then it disappears from there and now is over here in this place called the stock market. That's not what happened. When you buy, somebody writes a, you know, I want to go buy shares of stock from somebody, I write a check and give it to the guy, that money is still in the commercial banking system, right? He gives me the shares of stock, I transfer my money to him. What happens is the money goes from my checking account at my commercial bank into his checking account at his commercial bank. So the extra $1 trillion that the Fed created is still in the banking system, whether it's being used to buy equities or being used to buy real estate or being used to buy gold watches. So that's kind of what my concern is. There's no way ex post you can now look at the state of the financial sector compared to what it was on the eve of this massive injection of reserves and then say, oh, 18% went here and 14%, you would have no way. I mean, the money is still in the banks. It's just, it got moved around. Tony Cape says, what is my basic rebuttal to Denis Kucinich and his ilk who believe we should directly nationalize money? Yeah, so here the idea is a lot of these people, like I guess Alan Brown, I think, if I'm not getting mixed up, is one of the big proponents of this view. They understand and agree with the Austrians that it's crazy for this pseudo-private bank to create money out of thin air to then buy government debt, and then the taxpayers have to pay interest to these bankers who didn't even put up the money themselves. It's just the money they lent the taxpayers ultimately was just created out of thin air. So why are we having to pay $200+ billion? Well, we don't pay $200 billion just to them, but why do we have to pay many tens of billions of dollars in interest as taxpayers to these bankers who didn't even save money? They just created it out of thin air. That's crazy. So yes, that is crazy, but then the way they want to solve that problem is potentially even worse. They want to say, get rid of the Fed altogether. When the federal government wants to spend more than it takes in taxes, just have it run the printing press. So it won't be borrowed, so the taxpayers don't have to pay interest on that. It's just we get that money for free. In other words, why inflate and then have to pay interest on it? Why not just inflate? So that's the suggestion. And the basic answer, Tony, is I think that could be disastrous because the voters might then tolerate even higher federal spending. Because at least right now, say even though it's a messed up system, people still kind of understand that a deficit in some sense is irresponsible. It's profligate. It's a bad sign if you have to borrow money to meet your expenses. Maybe you can get away with it during a downtime like now, but you really ought to aim at having a balanced budget just like a household does. I mean, that's kind of what the average American thinks, I believe. If you then switch to a system where, no, if we spend more than we take in, we'll just print it. We don't, there's no interest cost involved. I think that would make people say, oh, well, then why not spend more money? And in fact, why not cut taxes? And why not just have the government just run the printing press and pay for all of its stuff? Because it wouldn't be as concrete to them that, oh, because that's going to then cause price inflation. So I'm concerned that if they switch to that approach in terms of the political economy of it, it might lead to much higher federal spending than the current system. I don't know that it would, but it seems to me if we're going to go to the trouble of getting rid of the Fed, let's not replace it with a printing press in the hands of Congress. I mean, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, I don't like the printing press in the hands of the central bankers, but I don't want to give it to Nancy Pelosi either. Tony is asking me about specific numbers or a trigger for the dollar crashing. I don't know, because it's, like I say, the kind of stuff I would have thrown out, I already would have thought would have been tripped. So I don't know what to tell you. I think part of what I'll just go about three more minutes, guys. I think part of the problem, or not problem, part of the situation is because Europe is so screwed up right now, people are flocking to the dollar as a refuge. So I think the dollar actually in absolute terms is fairly weak, but relative to the euro, it's better, at least in the short term. And so that's partly what's giving it this apparent strength, despite how weak I think it is, and people like me think it is. Okay, why don't I just do one more? Let me try to grab somebody who hasn't been. Okay, Tom Coots says, to protect oneself against what is coming, is there any difference between buying gold metal versus gold ETFs? Yeah, I think so. So if you're managing a huge portfolio, like with my dad, the kind of portfolio he has, for me to say you want 10% of that in gold, it would be impractical for him to have that much physical gold. I mean, he'd have to go store it somewhere. I mean, he couldn't just have it in his house because that's too much gold to have on you. So there, I mean, he could have an ETF. And there's various things, too. Like, you can have offshore companies that hold your gold and whatever. But where I'm going with this is in the kind of environment where the dollar really does crash, and, I mean, it's bad, and the price of gasoline is $15 a gallon, stuff like that, in that kind of environment, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if the federal government freezes all of the gold contracts, especially if some of these big hedge funds that allegedly have gold ETFs, what if they don't actually hold the gold? What if they've been shorting it because that's what Bernanke's been telling them to do, to keep to suppress the price of gold? You know, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that could be going on right now that we don't know about, and the fact that you have a piece of paper that says, oh, wait a minute, this company in New York owes me 800 ounces of gold, and it says right here I can call them up and they're supposed to ship it to me within 2 weeks if I do it, so I guess they're going to send it to me, right? And the government would be like, haha, yeah, there's a crisis going on, didn't you know? The Treasury Secretary announced it last week. No, those contracts are indefinitely suspended. So that's the kind of thing that could happen. So if you are worried about stuff and you're going into gold, I think you at least want to have personally a nice stockpile to at least get you through a few months. And even, I mean, I wouldn't even trust it in a safe deposit box at your local commercial bank because those things could get frozen. I'm talking like hiding it in your backyard or something. So, but obviously at some point it's stupid. You wouldn't want to have $200,000 worth of gold sitting under your bed because a burglar could take it. Okay, so that's what I mean. When you start getting up really big numbers, you can't have it physically on your in your property just because that's too risky also. So you'd have to make that decision. But for sure, I would say if you're holding it because you're worried about the world falling apart, well, don't think because you have a piece of paper and a signed contract with some Wall Street firm that they're going to put a bunch of gold in the mail and send it to you in that environment, because they might not. They might not even legally be able to. The government might say you can't do that. So just keep that in mind. Okay, with those happy thoughts, I'll stop there. Thanks, everybody. And if you're taking the course for credit, good luck on the final exam, which I will post next week and send out an email blast telling you all about the format and how to study for it. Did I miss any major questions? Yeah, so I will, if I missed any of these major questions, I'll review this after I log out, and the next burst of me answering questions on the forum, I will include these if I missed anybody's questions today.